We'll go back into open session and take up item seven, review the risk diversifying sub-portfolio. The first part is a report from staff. Tim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We did something similar about a month ago where we took one of the sub-portfolios, in that case it was a growth sub-portfolio, and spent a little time dissecting it. We review the role in the Cicera portfolio, the current structure and the rationale for that structure, some of the characteristics, performance, and any changes on the horizon that we bring a manager in. We're doing the same thing today with the risk diversifying portfolio, and there is a design to why we do these two back-to-back. The two interact a little bit more than the other sub-portfolio, and we'll step through that here. But maybe we could turn to slide three here. This is a chart we're all used to seeing here. The liquidity portfolio really is more of a standalone portfolio to pre-fund 4 years of benefit payments. It's fairly mechanical. It doesn't have immense amount of interaction with the other portfolios except for the annual funding plan to boost it back up. But the growth and diversifying really need to play together. And the reason they need to play together is the diversifying portfolio acts both as a counterweight to the volatility of a rather large growth allocation. I know in the exhibit they're showing the same size. In reality, as we know, the growth sub-portfolio is about 60+% and the diversified sub-portfolio about 8%. So that interplay, that offset to the volatility, needs to be fairly powerful in the diversifying program to offset some of the risk from the growth program. Now, we can accept that growth risk, that volatility there, both because of the overall design and because of the segment in diversify, because it's liquid. The reason it's important to be both a diversifying asset, so zig when the growth zags, and liquid is we intend to be able to use this to sell down some of the diversifying assets when we see equity market dislocation and move back in to the equity markets on the premise that we see mean reverting publicly traded markets. So if stocks are down 15 to 20%, we would be looking to the diversifying portfolio to be able to sell a portion of that and shift back in to some of those securities that are now more attractively priced. So with diversifying strategies, this is somewhat, it is the smallest program we have. It's probably the most difficult to define, and that's why we put out these three definitions, or three tests, really, that we put every investment through to see whether it qualifies as a diversifying asset. Because it's not, you know, it's not provision of income like liquidity or provision of capital appreciation like growth, it's really intended to be kind of this this flexibility tool here. So we are looking for low to negative correlation with global stock markets. We want that offset. We want that buffer on the downside. We're looking for high degree of liquidity, importantly, during periods of equity market stress. We want to make sure we don't end up with asymmetric liquidity where it looks liquid when the stock market looks liquid and looks illiquid when the stock market is down. That doesn't do us a whole lot of good as an operational tool. And we're looking for positive expected real return. And the reason that's important is we do intend this to be a strategic allocation, not a tactical allocation. We want to make sure it's not going to be a significant drag on overall results over a long hold period here. I think when we talked about this program probably 3 years ago, I had a graphic of a unicorn. Wearing a hoodie is why I remember that graphic. But we talked about this as the unicorn strategy. We don't often see all three aspects of this come together in a single investment. And we have to build up to a matrix that in aggregate delivers all three of these. So some of our investments deliver one, two, or three of these aspects. In aggregate, we're building up to all three of those working together. And so, you know, let's talk a little bit about where we look for these. Diversifying assets, as a rule, fall into two camps, either an explicit hedge or an implicit hedge. An explicit hedge, an example, would be what's called tail risk hedging. Essentially, buying insurance, so buying a put on the S&P 500 and being able to sell at a fixed price. That's an explicit hedge. The reason we don't look for those is they tend to be very expensive. They tend to be a cost in normal market environments and then be very powerful at a very discrete period, but it's difficult to hold them for the long term. You're going to see a negative return associated with that. It's like buying insurance on the house. I mean, you're paying your $1,000 every year and the house didn't burn down, well, it doesn't feel real great. Probably feels good not to have the house burned down. But paying that explicit piece in the overall investment portfolio tends to be a little bit of an operational drag and an attention drag more than anything else. So what we tend to look for is implicit hedges. And when we say implicit hedges, there's something about this asset class that just behaves differently than global risk assets. An example would be U.S. government guaranteed debt. Over most of the demonstrated history, we looked at this as has a negative correlation. It can go positive. It typically has a negative correlation. So we're looking for uncorrelated returns. Essentially, not an explicit offset, just something that doesn't have a whole lot of its behavior described by risk assets in general. And I think importantly, when we look at the opportunity cost column there, these are less expensive to hold. So they're not an explicit hedge. They're not an explicit positive payoff in a negative equity environment. But they're going to be either down less when the stock market is down considerably or maybe up positively. They're not necessarily that perfect downside hedge, but they're just going to be, it's a good diversifier in there. So we operate in that implicit range, or that implicit hedge type, which tends to be kind of the medium effectiveness range. We get a little bit more return, we get a little bit less downside protection, but it's where we tend to hunt for these pieces. And if we think back to the implementation of our current asset allocation structure, we really started all this back in 2015 when we had the conceptual discussion. In 2016 when we started implementing. So once we started implementing, we took a look at the overall portfolio and said, what from the existing portfolio belongs in liquidity? The answer was nothing. We restructured that. What belongs in growth? The vast majority of what we currently had belonged in growth. And what belongs in risk diversifying? And there was two strategies that we did reclassify into the space when we retested them through this lens. The two strategies we reclassified was AFL-CIO, which is a mortgage-based strategy with a government guarantee. So that government guarantee was a little bit of what we're looking for there. And we reclassified the Wellington diversified inflation hedging strategy as a downside protection strategy. We've talked about Wellington DIH ad nauseum. We understand that's probably going to be transitioned at some point, but today we're going to talk about AFL-CIO at the end of this. Maybe talk a little bit about what else has been going on. So in 2017, we said there's not an asset class that neatly fits this category, so we put our three definitions, our three tests out to the marketplace and said, hey, marketplace, show us your best ideas. And we got about 25, 26 strategies back, about four of which we thought were interesting. And the biggest complaint we had with these strategies is they were largely brand new or conceptual at the time. And so we've been tracking a number of them as they get in more of a live money track record. But that remains an ongoing work in progress. And you'll hear me every quarter talk about this is the piece of the portfolio that we continue to spend the bulk of our time on. We know it's a work in progress. We know we're not at our full allocation. That's because we're still tracking a lot of these strategies and seeing them tested. Whenever we get equity market volatility, we're going back and testing them, see, are these definitionally a fit for what we're looking for there? One of the ones we did advance out of that cohort in 2018 was the parametric defensive equity strategy, essentially the insurance selling strategy, selling puts, selling calls, investing the rest in treasuries, and harvesting that insurance premium. It's been a difficult environment for that particular strategy as equity market volatility has not been a fixed constant, has not even been a trend line, has been on or off. We're starting to see some better returns out of that one, but it's been a difficult start for that strategy. And so in 2019, really what we're focused on right now is cementing what we have in place and continuing our research on some prospective strategies there. But where we are today is an 8% overall allocation. So target allocation, 3.5% to AFL-CIO Housing Investment Trust, the mortgage with a government guarantee. The government guarantee provides that downside risk protection. The Wellington DIH as a placeholder as we move forward. and the parametric defense equity at 2.5%, a little bit higher allocation than what we expect to have long term. But again, some of that's strategic, some of that's as a placeholder as we build out additional pieces. We do envision taking this from an 8% allocation up to a 10% allocation long term, but we recognize that we need some more building blocks to be in place before we can take it up there.
What do you think the time frame is for that?
It's really over the next 18 months or so, and I'm going to touch at the end of the presentation on some of the pieces that we're looking at there. But performance to date, from an aggregate perspective, over the past year, about 5.5% net of fees from the risk diversifying, so positive rate of return. Over the 3 and 5 year periods, numbers are much lower there, so this is an area where we're not meeting the return expectation in the intermediate period here, largely based upon the types of strategies that are available in this space. The mortgage bonds have performed well, but not exceptionally strong relative to their overall track record, overall long-term track record, but that's competitive given the low interest rate environment that we've experienced here. Obviously, in the past year, you start to see those numbers bump up dramatically. Unfortunately, that's based upon lowered interest rate expectations in the future, and that's not something we would expect to see repeated. The Wellington TIH has performed okay over the past year, somewhat less for the 3 and 5 year periods, and parametric defensive equity, call it flat over the past year. That's starting to trend upward over the past 6 months. It dropped down, and we're starting to see them climb back out of that hole. But this is an area where we do expect to, it's not working as expected in aggregate, and we know there's a number of strategies we'd like to be able to implement. It's just a matter of getting through the due diligence process on some newer strategies there. So that is from a nominal return perspective. When we think about this in terms of a functional return perspective, setting those three goals out there, we say, is it an offset to the growth volatility? Well, yes. It's got a 0.5 correlation. We're thinking 0.2 to 0.6 is our typical target range there over a five-year period. Positive real returns, in this case, no. And then this is where we need to do some additional work here, but it has a negative real returns and net of inflation over the trailing five-year period. So this is an area where we're spending more time. And the high degree of liquidity, when we test these types of securities relative to equity market dislocations, and this is a lot of scenario testing, so this is more of a number that we come up with internally based upon past experiences and kind of playing out some scenarios. So this is never going to be a number that we can rely on wholly, but what we're seeing right now is based upon the scenarios that we do test and the scenarios that we do envision 100% liquidity within 90 days. We actually think we have about 85% liquidity within 5 days, so highly liquid. This is what I really want to touch on, though, when we talk about risk diversifying assets. This is a chart that plots trailing one-year performance versus MSCI ACWI. So the diagonal line is the performance of ACWI at any point in time. And the dots are the performance of the risk diversifying program over rolling one-year periods. And so because we were able to reclassify some of our existing strategies, we do have a nice long-term track record here. And when you start to see if we're running an MSCI ACWI index fund, every plot would be on the diagonal line. If the index performed 10, the product would perform 10. Here we start to see the index performing over a wide range of, we have the equity market dislocations in 2008, 2009. We have really strong rally returns. You see that the distribution of the risk diversifying strategies is really just in a flat line across here. When we talk about uncorrelated, this is what uncorrelated looks like. So this is something that we look to be our gut check. Are they performing as expected from a behavioral standpoint? Yes. Are they behaving as expected from a return perspective? That's where we need some additional work. So what we want to do is maintain this flat distribution and move that line up a little bit here. So to do that, some of the things that we're taking a look at in the future really come down to six strategies that we've been tracking for the past 2+ years now, largely in these three categories I put on the page. Multi-asset absolute returns. These are quantitative-based strategies that trade off trends and behaviors between asset classes, so tend to be large, quantitatively oriented shops that have these. There are two that we think might come to fruition. They're not formally in our research pipeline yet. They're in that tracking phase. One of these has the potential to be advanced rather quickly if we start to gain some additional confidence and maybe in front of the, or maybe in the portfolio as early as the first quarter of next year. We are looking at factor-based trend-following strategies. This one we're probably a little bit further back in terms of what we're thinking is a realistic timeline to be able to fund these. These would be more in the 9 to 18 month category. And then alternative risk premia. This is something we thought initially was rather attractive, and I understand that this has come across as jargon and that's something that you know about already. But just this is a preface for future board conversations here. Alternative risk premia basically says, can we identify some big drivers of securities and just invest in those big drivers on a quantitative basis? So value, momentum, these are some of the big factors out there. So we thought that might be something attractive initially. We've backed away from that a bit at this point. But we do expect to fund 1 to 2 new strategies kind of by June 30th of next year. So this is something where I want the board to be aware that we are actively seeking to improve the return profile and the manager count in this space for better diversification there. We have things that we think are going to be coming to fruition in the relatively near future, but we're not quite at a formal announcement point yet. Even though the press looked at my slide and said we've launched a formal search and my inbox has been exploding over the past week. But these are things that are that will likely be coming up in the fairly near future here. That was a really quick run through because this strategy or this sub-portfolio is really defined by what it's not rather than what it is. It's not equities. It's not necessarily income stream. It's kind of defined by these three questions that we have to ask about each strategy. So I wanted to go through that fairly quickly and then pause here before we bring up AFL-CIO to talk about their role in strategy. But I want to make sure that trustees understand, A, what the strategy is hoping to achieve, and kind of B, where we're at in that implementation cycle. Are there any questions?
There is. Jerry?
If you don't have to necessarily go back to number 9, because these are not necessarily presented in order of importance, but for me, positive real returns is number 1. I think that's what we're looking for. And somehow it strikes me that, I know you're working on it, but it strikes me as kind of leisurely to look at 1 year to 18 months, June with recommendations and then funding. In the meantime, we're looking at some fairly paltry returns if history is any indication. So that seems too long to live with that.
I think it's a fair critique. I would say what we've identified as prospective enhancements have largely been strategies that were launched in 2016, 17, and 18. And we certainly looked at strategies that had longer-term track records. What we couldn't get comfortable with on some of the strategies that we highlighted in 2017 as prospective was the liquidity profile. There are certainly things that could be return enhancers from day one, but they were not going to be liquid enough to be able to redeploy. And that was really the restricting factor on a lot of the research. We took a look at a couple of hedge fund strategies that would have 90 to 180-day lockup periods. So we failed the liquidity test at that point. There was a couple of things in the reinsurance space that, again, had some lockups associated with them. So we, my direction to my staff was step away from the things that are going to fail the liquidity test. If it's illiquid, we can deploy that elsewhere in the portfolio. This really, because it's not long-term growth, it's not current income, has to have that high degree of liquidity. That's been a restricting factor there. But it's a fair critique.
So is there anything to be said for any opportunity to accelerate this timeline without being imprudent, but to see if we can move a little bit faster? Because what we've got now is a high liquidity, which it passes that test, which means you could put your hands on the funds pretty fast.
Yeah.
But, you know, I can't get comfortable with a five-year real return of minus 1.2% for another year. That's, you can get better in a passbook.
Fair point. I would say what we're looking for here is natural experiments in the equity market. So we're really trying to find periods of equity market stress and then put everything through that filter. The past year has given us a couple of natural experiments. September gave us a natural experiment in that space. My staff is going through it right now. I do expect the first strategy to formally go through the research process during the last quarter of the year and potentially be funded in the first quarter of next year. Is there a way to accelerate it? I don't know that there's additional pieces that we can accelerate beyond what we've done. We need to see the data. I'm uncomfortable funding something based upon concept rather than data. But it is a primary focus.
And Tim, there might be a question of proxies for this space. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, I'd say when we talk about from the when we take a look at the CIO report that I issued to you in conjunction with the quarterly review, we do put a reference portfolio in there that uses treasuries, basically, as the proxy in that space. And that's probably as good as it gets in this space when we're trying to define a behavior rather than an asset class, is really that, you know, if there is a flight to quality, if there is concern in the risk assets, where does capital tend to flow? And it tends to flow into that government guarantee space. Gold would be the other one we could potentially take a look at. Gold tends to be, psychology plays a much larger role in the value of gold than it does in treasuries.
Jay? Oh, I think the proxy question was a great point there. And if you turn back to slide 10 and kind of look at the relationship between your pro forma performance versus equity markets in general, that really highlights the difficulty of filling out this allocation. Who wouldn't want a well-returning investment that doesn't move in line with equities? So I can understand the kind of protracted search timeline and the difficulty you're having in finding strategies that fill all three requirements here. But the idea of putting something in treasuries or maybe adding some duration there as kind of a stand-in until one of these three options is filled, I think has some merit. As you think about the potential strategies that you're going to include, are these all long-only kind of strategies with just a standard fee structure or?
It's a pretty broad mix. I mean, I'd say probably performance-based fee structures are half the strategies we're taking a look at. Flat fee structures are the other half. Four of the strategies are long only. Two are long short, have the ability to go short certain segments of the marketplace there. I really can't make a blanket statement just because this is we're trying to find those behaviors and wherever they might exist. And so I think we're, by definition, casting a broader net there. But I do take your point that if the period extends any longer than currently expected, a proxy in treasuries might make sense as a placeholder there.
Thanks.
All right. If there's no other questions from trustees on current composition or planned changes to the program, I'd like to go ahead and bring up Changsa of AFL-CIO. Chang is CEO of the organization and co-chief portfolio manager. He became CEO of the organization earlier this year. And this is an interesting strategy that I think we probably haven't spent a lot of time on in the past couple of years here. So it makes sense given the organizational change and what's going on in the multifamily housing sector to spend a little time on this.
Good afternoon. I'll introduce myself by your tinkering with the PDF. So thank you, Mr. Chairman and the board here. Contra Costa County's retirement system has been a long-standing relationship for the Housing Investment Trust, and indeed you are a very significant investor in our program. I believe the relationship goes back to 1991. I have been with the trust for almost 22 years now, and it's good to be back here. I think I was here 15 years ago in front of this board, and I'm on my fourth house since, two kids and a dog, so a lot's changed in my life, but again, really delighted to be in front of you again. The HIT has been around for 55 years in one form or another. Again, I've been with the organization for 22 years, and just listening to Tim about how we're being used in your overall portfolio really delights me. Clearly shows that there's an understanding of who we are. Sometimes I feel that we get lost in terms of how people see us because of the name. I also think people are misled because they see housing and they think we're real estate. So this is great to be here to have the opportunity to explain to you a little bit more about how we got here, who created us, who owns us, and how we do business. So, Tim, if it's okay, I'd like to go ahead and proceed with the presentation.
Yeah, so I'd like maybe just touch a little bit about changes to the organization and your ascension to the CEO position, what that's meant for the portfolio, what's meant for the organization. I'd like to spend some time, obviously, going over, and just so we're perfectly clear here, you're basically investing in debt that's backing multifamily housing that has a government guarantee associated with it.
That's correct.
So, got a lot of dynamics going on there, both in terms of what's going on in terms of demand for multifamily housing and what's going on in terms of suppliers of private capital and private debt capital into this space. So we'll touch on that as we go through this, but let's start with an organizational overview.
Yeah, sure. And just to keep it consistent, I was going to get to myself here in a few pages and have everybody follow along here in terms of the PowerPoint. So the Housing Investment Trust, we're a $6.6 billion mutual fund. And we offer a fixed income product. It's a very liquid product, and it emphasizes high credit quality. 99% of our assets have some kind of government support, U.S. government support. And over 99% of our portfolio is highly liquid, meaning we can sell that within minutes. So, again, this product's been around for a long time. It was interesting hearing Tim talking about how some of the other potential de-riskers in your portfolio need to be tested more. The nice thing about our product is that we've been around for 55 years. So there is a track record that you can back test to, and fortunately here we've actually had you in the fund since 1991. The HIT was a result of the AFL-CIO's Executive Council recommendation under President George Meany. There was a massive housing shortage going on in the 60s during the Civil Rights Movement, and there was recognition that that labor could pull together pension capital and create a vehicle that allows labor to help with the shortage of affordable housing while creating union construction jobs. So it started with the $1 million seed investment from a New York top charity fund, and here we are 55 years later, a $6.5 billion fund. We do have a labor policy. Everything that we invest in, if there's a construction component to it, we require that all the work be done by 100% union workforce. Page 3 talks about our impact investing. We're going to talk about the typical portfolio topics here in a moment, but I do want to touch on the impact investing and the history there, because we're very proud of that. The HIT has invested over $8.4 billion since 1984 into projects. That's 525 projects in 29 states, all of which were built by a union workforce. We have funded over 115,000 units of housing. 67% of that is affordable. And again, I want everyone to remember the affordable component as we go through our presentation, because again, this Bay Area that is experiencing a massive affordable housing crisis. It's not just in downtown San Francisco, it's spreading out. It has come here, from what I understand, in the Contra Costa County. It is a national issue, and we think it's a bigger topic for 2020 elections coming up, as well as just the ongoing concern for generations to come. In terms of where we invest, you can see on page 4 that we are a nationwide fund. However, about half of our investments have been in 5 major markets. You can see that New York City, Boston, Chicago, the Twin Cities, and Northern California. And we do a lot of deals in business and cities in between, but this lays out in terms of units, dollars, and projects where we've done a lot of our projects. So take a look at that. Tim mentioned during the introduction that I'm new in my role as the CEO. It's exactly about a year ago where I took office. I've been with the trust for 22 years, as I said. Most of that was as the chief portfolio manager for the Housing Investment Trust. And the previous CEO, after 26 years in office, had retired a year ago, and the board afforded me the opportunity to be our new CEO. And as I went through that process, I had to lay out a vision, a business plan. And really, my vision and my business plan to the board was really centered around 3 major areas. I wanted to make sure that the organization took a fresh look during this transition at our costs and fees. In fact, when I was here 15 years ago, I remember there was some discussion. It was 15 years ago, pension funds trying to drive or pushing to drive fees lower and lower. And as a fixed income product at the time that has a unique strategy, we stuck out in terms of our fees. We were probably around 41 basis points. And I would say over 22 years, I've only gotten really one area where we've been consistently criticized, and it was related to our fee level. Because again, as a low risk, very safe vehicle, we stuck out, even though we're very different in terms of how we execute. So I remembered being on the road and getting that feedback. So I told the board, look, it's important that we really take a shot at licking our fees and lowering our costs. So I wanted to make sure that we worked towards that. And I told the board that we would go from 42 basis points to 35 basis points over a 5-year period. I also told the board that it was very important to loosen up or change our investment authorities so that we have some more tools. Because over 55 years as an institution investing in affordable housing, we've developed a lot of experience, a lot of strength in terms of understanding how affordable housing projects get built. I felt like there were additional opportunities to add more yield to the portfolio, as well as having more impact in communities in terms of jobs and more units. So I wanted to make sure that we made an effort to look at our investment authorities and to see if we can enhance our strategy a little bit. So I'm happy to say it did take 5 years to lower our costs from 42 to 35 basis points. It took about 6 months. This year, again, I took over exactly a year ago. I asked the board to give me the current budget, and I would do a full organizational assessment. I spent my first 100 days in office looking at every part of the organization as if I was never there before. And we brought in outside specialists, a management consulting firm, and I also had a good idea that there were areas for improvement. So we went through a reorganization about 4 months into my job. I had to take on some tough decisions. I haven't been there a long time, but there was opportunity to get better So we had gone through a reorganization where currently we are operating and offering our fund at 35 basis points. That's down almost 18% from a year ago. It was supposed to take 5 years, and I felt that it was better to get it done and offer it sooner than later. We also were able to get the board's approval to expand our authorities to invest a small portion of our portfolio from HUD-guaranteed or GSE-guaranteed securities into direct investments in multifamily projects. I made the case to the board that we see a lot of opportunities in subsidized housing projects where there is no lease-up risk because of all the strong support from the public sector that these transactions will lease up, will be built, will be occupied, and that there was opportunity to create more yield, create more work, and build more housing. We were able to do that in June. We did our first direct deal in July, did another one in August, and we were working on another large project that should close here in the next couple weeks. So we are way ahead of schedule in terms of my vision for lowering costs. We've done that. I wanted to take the new investments in terms of the job-creating investments, the creation of affordable housing investments. We had, for over 20 years, put out 10 to 11 deals a year. I wanted to double that. I wanted to go from $250 to $270 million a year of job creating new development-related transactions to doing over $500 million. Again, I had laid out a plan that, hey, if we do certain things, we can get there in 5 years. I'm happy to report that if we close out the remaining quarter of this year, the way I think we are, we're going to hit close to $600 million of new investments, and which would be, again, another record for us. So we're off to a really good start. Pleased to report that. Let me pause to see if anyone's got any questions in terms of the organizational changes and changing the CEO position.
We have one.
The AFL-CIO are tax co-investors in this trust.
I'm sorry, the AFL-CIO and who?
Is AFL-CIO acting as a co-investor in the trust or an investor in the trust?
Well, that's a real good question. I should be more clear. So we have the name the AFL-CIO. We are not under their umbrella. It was an idea that came out of the AFL-CIO. We essentially licensed the name, the AFL-CIO, at zero cost. But we do have representation on our board. Half of our board members are labor-affiliated board members. The AFL-CIO has a staff retirement plan. They're a small investor in the trust, but they do not co-invest in transactions with the HAT. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, and I'm just trying to understand if you lower your fees, which is great. I'm just trying to sort out where else you make that money back.
I mean, the great news is we're a strict pass-through entity. We are a pure mutual fund. So when we lower the cost of our operations from 42 to 35 basis points, you as the investor benefit 100% of that savings. So we essentially added 7 or 8 basis points of guaranteed yield going forward by reducing our overhead.
And David, your question was really around what's the role of the union in the trust, or I'm trying to understand what the genesis of your question was.
Well, I guess I didn't understand the relationship with the AFL-CIO. So this is just simply an investment trust that just has the name, but not really under any control or co-investment or anything like that. They're just a small part of it, but okay.
So the AFL-CIO has representation on our board and in our prospectus and in our guidelines. You know, we have a set of values. We think building union, paying fair wages and benefits, it's an important in a condition of taking our money, we also just believe that pension funds, not only capped target funds, but public pension funds, can be a great resource of driving economic activity and be done prudently. So we're a living example of responsible investing that's been around for five decades. But yeah, I work for you all directly. You are my boss, not the AFL-CIO. They may have representation on our board, but I am a direct employee of the fund, which is very unique. There is no profit that gets driven to a contracted advisor, to say
so. So having the name basically just reflects your strategy with respect to
the labor
using union labor, yes, to build these projects, and with their pension and so forth, and getting pension plans to invest in your project. And so that's part of one of the slides you have on there that reflects that. So.
Exactly. In fact, the next page shows you that where our money comes from. We have 374 investors. About half of our money comes from the building trades unions. And then we get a quarter of our money from public pension funds and the balance from industrial and service. So as you would expect, we would have strong support from the building trades union because they have the most direct impact in terms of the jobs that they get out of it. But I will tell you, we have a quarter of our money from public pension funds. We have San Francisco on top of the CRS. We have NYSERS, the city of New York. There are many pension funds that I think are more and more concerned about directing some of their capital to their counties and cities and states so that they can get jobs and housing out of it. We are an ETI manager for New York City and the state of Massachusetts Pension Fund. They have a mandate at their level where a certain percentage of their pension portfolio has to be invested with managers that will invest in their city or state. So New York City collectively has almost $1 billion with us, and it started in 2002 where there was this recognition they needed more affordable housing, they needed more workforce housing. So they said, hey, we need all the resources possible to do more housing. So we got $100 million, and we committed that we would take at least half of that invested in New York City. Well, here we are 15 years later. We've invested over $1.5 billion into New York City, created tens of thousands of units that they otherwise would not have had. So public sectors can really benefit and align our strategy with their broader objectives. So I just wanted to make sure that we shared that with you. There is impact beyond housing and the construction trades. You know, we have time for time invested in hospitals that are guaranteed by Ginnie Mae in assisted living and senior housing projects that are, again, Fannie Mae or Ginnie Mae insured. And if there are ongoing operations, we require that the operators are unionized. So so you have 1199 SEIU employees that benefit from our capital in those projects. We have also invested in some teacher village housing projects where we're creating teacher housing in markets, and we think that we're going to see more and more of that. So the AFL-CIO name does mean that we have to be very sensitive to the labor situation as it relates to our projects.
John?
Just clarifying what I think is fairly straightforward. If you mandate that all labor is union, you're mandating a higher price in almost all cases for the project. Are all these projects, or substantially all, supported by government? Is that, where does that come into play? For example, San Francisco, this was an article in the last week or so, in building low-cost housing, is something like $750,000 to build a very small condominium that is going to be described as affordable housing. Obviously, presumably, that's not affordable to the individual who's going to support the 750, so somebody has to subsidize that. I'm trying to get a handle on
You're obviously not in southern states. You're not in most of the Midwest, I would assume. You're in New York, New Jersey, California, where the union side is strong. Are these all government subsidized or supported?
Well, you know, 70% of our construction-related investments are affordable or have affordability in them. In terms of the cost impact to a project because of union labor, yes, I mean, I believe that overall the marketplace has this perception that if you use union labor, it's going to be a higher cost, and that goes against making the deal more affordable. You know, we work with developers and sponsors that I think look just beyond that one line item. Again, I think there's a strong case to be made that if you build something on time with a higher level of quality, you're going to get that back in terms of, you know, shorter construction period, shorter carry during construction, and again, less work, less, you know, change orders, etc. We have to compete. So if there is a project in San Francisco that's going to be built, that developer is going to go to the banks, they're going to go to life companies, they're going to go to pension funds, and we're competing for it. So we have to offer something that draws them to our capital. Generally, you'll see us in strong union markets. So I think most of the deals that we're going to get into in San Francisco are going to be largely union anyway. To meet our 100% requirement, you know, they were probably already going to be 80-90%. I'm not sure if that delta necessarily drops us off. We're patient capital. We have $6.6 billion. And unlike a lot of institutions that are looking for, you know, 1-, 2-, 3-year returns and certain benchmarks and certain profit levels, we can operate differently from that. As you are using us kind of as a government bond substitute, where a 10-year treasury is offering 1.6% yield, we can offer a portfolio that has a treasury credit quality and offer a 3.2% yield. So we're going against markets that are, or lenders that are offering, let's say, 4.5% on a construction loan. We can offer 3 or 3.5 and still get a much better fixed income return for your portfolio or pension portfolios and wrap our hands around the risk and still be competitive enough to compel the developer to use 100% workforce to build a project. So, we add value by our technical expertise, our ability to be able to lock in advance, and we have patient capital. So we can often actually be the permanent takeout on a construction loan, where most banks, they don't want to do that. They want to be in and out in 2 or 3 years. We actually love getting the takeout loan on top of the construction loan because we know that there's value there. So we can kind of price that in and put ourselves in a position where, wow, that's compelling. If I have to build that larger union anyway in San Francisco to get to 100%, yeah, maybe there's a little bit of a bump up there, but we have to go to them and we offer value in different ways to convince them to use our money.
So I think one of the things that's important, and I'm not sure that we've really conveyed it yet, is how you're getting an investment into kind of your research pipeline, how you're holding it, how you're getting the government guarantee associated with it, because I think it is the timeline there that's kind of critical and might address some of, John, you're raising questions about upfront costs, but where are the offsetting pieces of this? And so maybe you could highlight that workflow of how you're sourcing your deals,
sure,
how you're holding them, et cetera.
Yeah, so, when Ginnie Mae or Fannie Mae multifamily mortgage-backed securities trade in the marketplace, almost every investor out there, they're just going to pick up the phone and say, I want to buy that, $20 million mortgage related to that apartment across the street. That's how they trade to every other money manager. With us, we have the business development officers out there working with developers, sponsors, city offices. We get involved into our projects years prior to them breaking ground. And What we bring is certainty of execution. All right, well in advance of when a bank or an institutional manager would invest in that mortgage. We also direct them to potential sources of subsidies. We give them flexibility, such as the ability to rate lock early, maybe sometimes 6 months, a year in advance of when they otherwise would be able to rate lock. We also work with a huge network of licensed HUD lenders, GSE lenders. They know the markets that have union workforces available, and they go ahead and market our money for us. And then when there's a site that is coming up a year or two in advance, we get involved and we say, look, these are the points, the value points that we can bring to this transaction. Sometimes it's pricing, sometimes it's flexibility, sometimes it's just understanding, that deal is not risky as what it really looks like to someone else. So we put a lot of effort into sourcing these transactions, and if we didn't bring value to that affordable housing project, we wouldn't get the business, because as you asked, we're not lending to the AFL-CIO, we're not lending to unions, they're not double dipping, getting higher wages, higher fees, and a lower rate. We're dealing with the private marketplace that accepts our money.
That's helpful.
Okay. Jay, then David.
Sorry, just a quick question for Tim, actually. Is there a non-investment objective related to our investment here? Is it what we...
Yeah, in terms of an economically targeted investing?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, there's not. There was originally. So we go back to the genesis of this. Sarah did have an ETI policy, and that was part of it. We took a look at this through the lens of what's the behavior of these types of securities in the marketplace. We said, when we could reclassify an existing investment as meeting some of the goals here, we took a look at that and said, we understand what the investment trust is trying to do. Let's take a look at the outcomes. Do the outcomes fit our investment goals here? So the ETI aspect of this, while I understand critical to you all, we look at this through the investment lens and saying, we understand that's a sourcing model to get securities in the front door. We take a look at the yield and the government guarantee as the pieces that we're trying to harvest in the investment portfolio. So this is, I think, whenever we talk about ETI investments, economically targeted investments, or ESG investments, things that have a social, environmental, or governance aspect of it, we're more than happy to take a look at those if it's a unique sourcing model, but we're always taking a look at the outcomes and saying, do the outcomes fit our investment goals?
David? I'm sorry, and just to clarify, you pretty much purely just provide capital. When you get involved in a project, it's the developer handles all of that stuff. You're just providing the funds for it. Okay.
Yeah. We're a liquidity provider. We provide debt capital.
Okay. And the performance, over 1 year, it's jumped up to 5.4 compared to the 3 and 5 year average. Aside from the real estate market being up over the last couple of years, is there to get a reason why?
Oh, sure. I was going to get to it here in the presentation, but really quickly, we are a fixed income product. Our benchmark is the Burgers Aggregate Bond Index. We have duration. We manage our interest rate risk relative to the X. So this past year, as you know, interest rates dropped quite a bit. So in that type of environment, you would expect us to appreciate in value in terms of return. So we've benefited, like other fixed income portfolios, with lower rates.
Yeah. So just to be super clear, providing the debt capital, then becoming a security on your exit, basically. You're providing that debt capital with packaging and a security, getting the government guarantee associated with it. So it's the origination aspect of this. It's unique relative to most of the bond managers who are trading on the secondary market. They're creating the bond. But once you're... When you highlight that one-year number, that's because the bond duration benefit over the past year with rates declining. Yeah. Not, I don't know, assume that had
the organic performance of the underlying securities or the underlying deals really didn't change dramatically over the past year.
No. Again, we're going to get to it here in a moment, but over time, when you're not losing money as a bond portfolio because it's all government guaranteed, it's really going to be yield that generates your long-term return. So when you see spikes up in return or spikes down, it's temporary. And that's the great thing about our product, right? And you're using it in the right way. You know that our money's going to be there. You know that it's liquid, and you can anticipate that yield and that income on a regular basis.
Yep. Scott? Just a quick question, and it may already have been covered, but in terms of the debt vehicle, do you take on entitlement risk at all or no?
No.
None?
No.
It appeared not, but I just wanted to understand.
Okay. So a developer has a deal locked up, they're entitled, they're ready to go, they need the capital. That's when they, you know, that's when they take your capital, but you're engaged in conversation with them prior to that.
Yeah, and everything, when our money goes into the deal, everything's baked, entitlements are there, you know, all the underwriting is in place. So, again, if you look at 2008, when the real estate markets tanked, when there was a housing crisis, you know, a world economic crisis, that was one of our best years ever, right, because the safety, the government guarantee aspect of it. But even away from the guarantee part, I can't recall one project and then a deal in 1998 in the 22 years that I've been doing this where that project's gone under. And that was a family situation between the developers anyways. But you'd have to go back to 1998, and we actually made money. We didn't lose a single penny on that. But that's the only deal that I'm aware of in the 300 or 400 deals that have taken place in the past 22 years where the deal did not work. So it shows you that the underwriting, the due diligence that we put on every transaction, it really pays off. And then going back to the whole, we like being the permanent takeout for the construction loan. There's spread there. If you get in during construction, you can charge 5% on the permanent loan versus, let's say, 4% on a permanent loan. So holding that piece 2 years in advance allows us to pick up 8 or 9% of potential return because the spread between a construction loan and a permanent loan contracts by about 100 basis points sometimes. Again, just recapping, you know, our fund, what we want to do is we want to generate competitive returns. We emphasize high credit quality, high degree of liquidity, and we also value collateral benefits like union construction jobs, more affordable housing in communities, and driving economic activity. The specific objective of the HIT is to outperform or generate competitive risk-adjusted returns versus the aggregate bond index. We've been able to do that 25 of 26 years on a gross of fee basis, 16 out of 25 on a net of fee basis. So again, a long track record of strong, consistent performance. Really, the strategy is very straightforward. We have an expertise, a competency, in understanding affordable housing development finance. So what we want to do is we want to use our expertise. We want to overweight in multifamily mortgage-backed securities because they offer the credit quality that we're seeking. They offer more yield and income than you would otherwise get in a fixed income security with similar risks. And again, we don't believe that anyone can consistently call interest rates. So we believe that you have to be, you know, over the long run, duration or interest rate risk neutral versus the markets. Page 11, it's a quick snapshot of the advantage from a portfolio perspective. We have 95%, you can see, in U.S. government or agency credit. The ag has only 72%. And let me tell you what that difference is. Most bond portfolios that are in a core product, you know, you would have the ag or you would have, in other words, 28% of the ag is in corporate bonds, and most of that is in BBB credit. So when there's a recession and the stock market tanks, you're often going to have corporate bonds in BBB that actually underperform and not provide diversification that you would need. And that's what you saw in 2008. Everybody that got cute through fixed income in 2008 did not have the liquidity or the performance that they were counting on. The HIT, because of our government insurance and credit, performed very well in 2008. And that's because we don't have corporate bonds, right? But we have more yield. See, core managers typically get yield from corporate bonds, but they're taking on correlation with the equity markets. We feel that, hey, we can get investments that give you more yield with less correlation. So that's really the simple trick to why we make sense as a diversifier in a pension portfolio. You can see that there's a yield advantage for the HIT versus the AG. Duration level, very comparable to the AG. And even though we're in mortgages, we have prepayment protection, which is really important, because when you have interest rates fall like they did this past year, if we were a regular mortgage manager, our return would be 5.5%. Our return's over 10% because our multifamily mortgages have prepayment protection, which allows value to go up, and you don't have that prepayment and reinvestment risk that you would get from a typical mortgage manager. So again, another neat part of what we bring here as a fixed income product. We touched on performance here already. Across the board, I'm very proud of these returns. You know, yes, we identify the AG as our primary benchmark. No, we don't look anything like it. We don't have corporate bonds. They have 28% corporate bonds. We're underweight single-family mortgages. If you look at our portfolio from a risk perspective, I believe that the AAA component, the AAA index of the Barclays AG is a better measure on a risk-adjusted basis. So for the level of risk that you're taking with the HIT, you can see that we significantly outperform across the board, year-to-date, 1 year, 3 year, 5 year, and 10 year. Some more historical returns on page 13. Again, I want to point to 2008 really quickly, 2009, and then the previous recession, the 01 recession. If you want to go back, you can see how well we do. Pages 14 and 15, just a pie chart of our portfolio. You can see the Fannie Freddie and Ginnie Mae emphasis on page 14. And then page 15, you can see the breakout between what percent of our portfolio currently is permanent multifamily mortgages. You can see that we have 11.6% of our money currently under work in construction-related investments.
Chang, maybe we just briefly go back to 14 real quick.
Sure.
I think a natural question when we take a look at the strategy, that given that from the investment lens, the government guarantee and the yield advantage are really kind of the big differentiations we're looking at here. Sorry, go back one more. Let's take a look at that green portion there, and this, compare that to where we're seeing headlines right now. That's backed by Fannie and Freddie.
Yes.
And, you know, I think the drumbeat is slightly louder today for privatization of Fannie and Freddie than it has been in a while. How do you think about that potentiality in terms of how it would impact the portfolio? And, you know, is that a real risk that you worry about in today's market environment or prospectively?
Sure. We think about it and we follow it regularly. It's an important event. I would say, your question number one, how would our portfolio behave or how would it be impacted if we privatized Fannie and Freddie? I believe our returns would go through the roof. That's because the supply of government agency credit, protective securities, just went down in terms of our space, right? And if we get rid of Fannie and Freddie, the proposers are advocating that, you know, the new system would have an explicit guarantee from Ginnie Mae. So if that's the case, those new securities trade really, really thin and tight, and the spreads that we're marking our current portfolio are well above where it would be.
Okay.
So it would be a positive for the current investor.
And how likely would you handicap that possibility in the next 5 years of a full privatization of those two?
I would say it's probably about a 30%, 25 to 30% likelihood that it would happen in the next 5 years. 2020 is a big year for the country in terms of elections. There's a lot going on, and we're all following the news. I'm from Washington, D.C. There's more geopolitical uncertainty there's ever been in our city, in our country. So for anyone to have the courage and the political power and will to try to change a $6 trillion system right now, I think that's suicidal. So I don't see that happening. But I was wrong. I didn't see the people that were in the current White House as getting in the White House when 4 years ago or 3.5 years ago. So, yeah, there's a real possibility, but I think that it would take a very bold, you know, effort by someone that is risking everything to make that happen. I don't see what the upside is. Housing's rebounded. In fact, we're saying there isn't enough housing. We have an affordability issue in every major market, and you want to tinker with the system that was designed to create more affordability in housing? I just think that it's unlikely. Great question, though. They're talking about it.
And then maybe just on 17, let's talk about a little bit more on demand side for multifamily housing. I mean, you've touched on it several times there, but maybe some of the metrics around what you're seeing in terms of the marketplace here.
Yeah, you know, following 2008, the building trades and the construction world just, you know, they were devastated, right? 30% unemployment for the construction workers around the nation. No cranes, no activity. So the first bit of life came through building apartments. We had gotten into a financial mess by promoting ownership and promoting people to get second, third homes and spec homes, right? So home ownership, as you can see on page 17, went from like a 40-year average of like 65% in our country, spiked up to 70%, and then the crash happened, and you can see it came way back down to its normal levels. So, you know, there's been a lot of building, but for many reasons. You know, you can see that, one, vacancy rates are below 5% nationally, so that's a positive. Rent growth is still very strong, 4.3% annually here in the second quarter. There's just been a shift in terms of home ownership affordability. It's not just that home prices are going up. It's just that wage growth has not kept pace with other parts of the economy. You know, wage growth has been very stagnant, around 2% for the past 10 years, while home prices and rents have gone up 4, 5, 6, 7% a year. So over the long run, you know, real estate has become very, very, very expensive. You can see in page 17, the Great Recession again made a huge dent. And I think this is the most important chart that you could look at in terms of what to expect going forward. For 30 years, you can go back to the 60s, our country has been creating about 1 million households a year. All right. And then in 2006, for about 4 or 5 years, it drops down to about 600,000. So people didn't disappear, right? It's just people couldn't afford homes. They didn't have jobs. They couldn't get credit to get out, get married, have kids. It's, you know, over 10 years of slow recovery. We're back to a normal level. We haven't caught up yet, but demographic growth and household formations are going to spike through the roof here, and I'll get to the real reasons why. On page 18, you know, Tim asked me to comment on, you know, the different generations here, the merging of Generation Z and millennials, and that's a huge, huge factor here as we look at supply in the future. You know, you're going to have this youth boom where the millennials are, you know, kind of getting married and at similar levels of life with the Gen Zs. So collectively, they make up most of our country, right? And you can see the choices that these generations are making. You know, less than 60% of people between 25 and 34, all right, live with a spouse or a partner compared to 80% in 1967. It's just simple. People can't get out of mom and dad's roof as quickly as they used to. Student loans, you know, that's a big part of it. And really the decline of manufacturing good blue-collar jobs, right? So you can't just go into a factory and make the median household income in that area and afford to live on your own. So
more and more kids have been stuck with mom and dad, haven't been able to get out. But eventually, it's, you know, it's biology. It's in our DNA. People need to get out on their own, get married, and have kids. So we're starting to see that, you know, pressure in terms of demand. And that's why I really think that apartment and multifamily demand is going to just spike through the roof for the next 20, 30, 40 years. We're already short of it in terms of affordable and workforce housing, but the demographic combination of Gen Z and Gen Y, it's going to create a big surge up in demand.
So are you seeing that in terms of the pipeline of deals that you're taking a look at, that has it started to increase materially, or is that still on the horizon here?
Our pipeline is incredibly strong because, again, affordability has just been getting worse and worse. We see anecdotes of Gen Z and Gen Y preferences, you know, in terms of lifestyle trends. We have developers that we've known for three or four decades where they're building micro units. You know, again, 775,000 affordable unit in San Francisco, you know, probably needs to be, you know, 400 or 500 square feet, you know, max, when you look at what we need to do 10 years from now to have a sustainable city there. But micro units are actually preferred now by, you know, Gen Z and Gen Y folks because they want amenities, they want communities, they want to have a, you know, a dog or pet area, you know, on the property versus having, you know, more space or bigger kitchens. So you're seeing some of these, you know, lifestyle preferences. But I would say that our pipeline has just, it's been really positively impacted by the ongoing shortage of housing everywhere. We haven't seen a big spike up because of any of this. No.
So I guess one of the other questions that comes up here, you're talking about robust demand on the horizon, steady supply of the product right now. What's going on with the competitive landscape for providing the debt capital in the first place? I mean, certainly we've had conversations in this boardroom about the role of private capital, understanding that that's not necessarily targeted towards these pieces here, but yeah, I think the hunt for yield has been dramatic over the past couple of years. The role of sovereign wealth funds in directing some marginal flows has been disruptive in certain marketplaces. In terms of a competitive marketplace, what are you seeing in terms of your, you know, who you're going up against when you're trying to provide capital to some of these deals, and is it impacting pricing or terms at this point?
Yeah, great question. You know, the affordable space is so different from what's happening typically across the macro economy, but within the affordable space, it's very competitive. Banks are incredibly aggressive. They can't get enough product in their portfolios. There are CRA requirements that they have to meet as a bank. And if they have a branch in a zip code, they have to invest a certain amount of activity in that zip code to, you know, advance housing and other CRA objectives there. So bank spreads on the affordable deals are tight as I've ever seen them.
Can we just define CRAs? Make sure everybody knows. Yeah,
Community Reinvestment Act. Okay. It just requires banks to give back to communities of need in terms of economics.
Okay.
Yeah. Life companies, you know, they are primarily in the market rate transactions. I would say that's market to market, neighborhood to neighborhood. From what we know, we think apartments are like in the favored nation. Of where people want to put their money because it's easier to understand, it's more reliable, you know, having 600 tenants versus relying on Best Buy or a retail anchor in an alternative investment vehicle. So I know that there's a project that we've been wanting to push forward in Milwaukee for 6 years. Milwaukee's really had quite a bit of a turnaround, and this site's probably the best site in the entire state looking over the lake. But again, the product that the developer wants to build is a really high-end product with like 400 units. And it's been sitting because he just can't get institutional equity partners to come in and support, you know, a super ultra-high-end product in Milwaukee. We're seeing that in other markets like Boston, New York, you know, the condo market, the high-end rental market. Yeah, there's some oversupply happening there. But I think if you look around like the Twin Cities, the state of Minnesota, you know, where it's like 200 to 250,000 a door, projects like that are getting done and everybody wants to go after it, the local banks, the national banks, institutional money. So I would say that in summary, the high-end product people are getting a little skittish about. Everything kind of middle of the road and low-end, everyone's fighting and scrapping for.
Okay.
You know, we spent a lot of time talking about, you know, all the positives of affordable and workforce housing demand, so I'll skip through this page relatively quickly. You know, we are a bond fund, so it's appropriate to just have a quick page here on inflation expectations, interest rates, and you know, what we see and think. Again, I'm going to say we don't have a crystal ball. If I did, I wouldn't be here. but, you know, we think that you can't just say, hey, rates are low. It's going to come back up. We've been saying that since 2004, right? Rates have been really, really low for a long time. And there's a real good reason why. It's a more globalized world and economy. There's the internet, there's machines, productivity gains. We're, you know, exporting our jobs, hiring cheaper labor in China and Mexico. So there's just been a new paradigm shift, right, in terms of how people source product and services. So that's why we're all struggling with getting inflation up to 2%. The Fed is fighting for their lives right now to get up to 2% inflation. They can't do it. They're cutting. And next week they're going to cut another 25 basis points. And the markets are pricing in another 25 basis points, possibly in December. So it tells you that they are concerned. Real simple anecdote to keep an eye on. Look at yields in Europe. They're negative. The 10-year bond rate was negative 76 basis points. All right, you want to get, if you want to borrow money, they pay you to borrow money. So it tells you that there's global growth concerns, capital market concerns when the central banks are cutting rates and exercising quantitative easing. So it's strange. We have 3.7% record low unemployment, but yet we're cutting rates. Right? So I urge investors, if you want my 2 cents, be diversified. Don't go all in here. Don't go all in there. Spread it out because all of this is really being driven by something that's new, you know, globalization, populist politics changing the world, geopolitics in Washington, D.C., scary as it's ever been. When I say scary, I'm not choosing sides. I'm just telling you, you can't predict it. Right, as a money manager, as an investment manager, scary means uncertainty. So there is no certainty in this world right now. That means risks are high. That means rates are likely to stay close to where we are until there's certainty. So, you know, I'm going to close with that and see if there are any questions.
Are there any questions?
Okay, seeing none pop up. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jim. Thank you.